being solved or set new light on using methods of pH, gravity, or RNA. And I'm going to divide them into two broad classes of problems, which I call them as a conformal quantum matter and compressible quantum matter. And these names are exactly what they suggest. In this case, these are generic model systems, rather special ones though, which in the end do realize a conformal field here. So there's an emergent conformal symmetry that can be realized in the laboratory. And for such systems, it's perhaps not too surprising that you could use the ADS-CFT correspondence, because at least you have a CFT, although you may not have supersymmetry. So these are simpler systems in a sense, which much work has been done in condensed matter without the help of cage gravity duality. But I believe that there are some interesting strong coupling questions there for which cage gravity duality will play a role in our eventual understanding. And this part of my talk is, in a sense, relatively well established in the sense there's been quite a bit of work and we know where roughly this is all going. In the second part is the more speculative but also the more interesting, the more active part of the field, which is studying compressible quantum matter. And by compressible meaning, again, that you have some bunch of stuff which you can compress by applying pressure, loosely speaking. And somewhat surprisingly, if you think of quantum systems at zero temperature, it's actually quite difficult to get things to be compressible. There's only a few examples of compressible states of matter that we know. I list all of them, in fact, I believe, in my talk. So now there's the more general problem of classifying compressible states, which I think gauge gravity duality will play a role in. Of course, in this case, we're not even close to studying the kinds of system that we have in the laboratory. But nevertheless, just in the broader problem of classifying different compressible states, it will be very useful to have a different perspective. Okay. So this is the condensed matter way of thinking about things. Now, what happens in the gauge gravity duality is that each one of these states of matter gets mapped to some geometry. And the basic geometry that will appear here, I keep forgetting that this thing is not working, in this case will be I'll talk mainly about two-dimensional quantum systems, and they map out to, when they're conformal, to anti-de-Sitter space with four dimensions. And at finite temperature, there's a horizon, and so you get a Schwarzschild Bragg brain. And this has really been a very useful starting point for studying conformal states, and also in relatively good shape. If you take the same strategy in studying compressible states, then you get a much more complicated object. It's what's called a Reisner-Nordström horizon of a black brain or a black hole. And when you go really near the horizon, there's a factorization of the geometry where it becomes, has this anti-de Sitter space 2 factor times R2. I'll explain what that is to the condensed matter theorists a little bit anyway. And this has been the basis of a large amount, this geometry has been the basis of a large amount of work over the last 3 or 4 years. Addressing different compressible states of quantum matter. Unlike the ADS-4 case here, there's many open questions, I mean, of even the very basic level, of whether this is even the right starting point. But I'll describe some of the results and my interpretation and perspective on these results. Okay, so that's the outline of my talk. So let me, for the first part, be on somewhat more solid ground and talk about conformal quantum matter. Okay. All right, so what are systems that are conformally invariant? So here is, in fact, one. So you take bosons with repulsive interactions moving in some periodic potential, as you can realize with ultra-cold atoms. And I want them to be in two dimensions, and there are experiments at Chicago which are two dimensions. These experiments were in three dimensions. So the bosons hop around. If the repulsion between the bosons are weak, they hop rather freely, and you get a superfluid state. So if you were to tilt that lattice, the bosons would flow without dissipation. And when they repel each other more strongly, there's a phase transition, a quantum phase transition, to an insulator where you have one boson per side, and that's shown in this picture, where now if you tilted the lattice, nothing much would happen. Okay. So a simple model system for describing this is the Bose-Hubbard model, and this is really a generic type of model that you would use, bosons hopping on some lattice with some repulsion u, and the basic parameter then is u over t, and as you vary the coupling u over t, you can get these two types of states. So now the question we want to ask is, how do you undergo a phase transition between these two states, and what is the low energy theory near the critical point? So one way to very quickly to understand the nature of the field theory is to actually begin not from the superfluid, but from the insulator. And in this insulator, you have one particle per site. And then you ask, what are the excitations of the insulator? Well, there's two types of excitations as you move these atoms around, which have an energy gap in the insulator. So you can add a particle, and that costs some energy because these two are repelling each other. It has to come from somewhere else because you have one particle per site. And so there's also a hole excitation here, corresponding to removing a particle, and that also costs energy because, well, in the grand canonical ensemble anyway, you're losing the gain of energy of having a particle there. So that's what's different from the ordinary Bose gas in flat space without a periodic potential. There you only have particles. You don't have holes. Here, because you're starting not from empty space but from a from an insulator with one particle per site, you have particles and holes. But more importantly, the density of particles is equal to the density of holes. And that's really the key thing. That's the only thing you need, ultimately, and the global U1 symmetry, to argue that the critical point is actually relativistic field theory. So that's, at this point, a well-established statement supported by lots of numerical work, that the low-energy theory of the superfluid insulator transition in two dimensions is this type of relativistic field theory, where psi is just the particle creation operator. So it's sort of like ordinary, this would be the theory for a charged meson with a certain mass if you're doing relative particle physics, and this is the mass of the meson. Now here you can tune this, as you tune the coupling u over t, you can tune this to zero, and then there's a phase transition as a function of g between the insulator, which is the gap state that I just showed you, to the condensate in this relativistic theory, which is a superfluid. And then this critical point, so the low energy theory in both phases near the critical point is relativistic, but if you sit right at the critical point, the theory is not only relativistic, it's also scale invariant and therefore also conformally invariant. So you have the full set of symmetries of a conformal field theory over here. All right, so this conformal field theory, in fact, goes back to the very first fixed point, non-trivial fixed point of the RG discovered by Wilson and Fisher in 75, I think. Although they didn't mention it's conformal invariant, it is indeed conformal invariant, and today there's a lot of evidence for that. And there's even a lot of exciting work, in fact, here at Perimeter, on writing down gravity duals of this particular conformal field theory. Okay. All right. Now, but if you want to address questions like, what are the scaling dimensions of various operators? What are the critical exponents? There are beautiful tools for that, numerical tools, epsilon expansion, 1 over n expansion, all done to very high order, and everything is in great shape. Critical exponents are known to 3 or 4 decimal places. So you would say, why do I need anything else for this problem? And you'll be right if this is the questions you're addressing. But now let me take this quantum critical point and turn on a temperature. Okay. All right. So then you have this kind of universal type of crossover phase diagram, which I won't spend too much time on, but just to make the basic point, there are qualitatively two different types of regions. First, there are the blue regions, and these are the regions of conventional solid-state physics, where you have, say, in this region, you have an insulating ground state. You raise the temperature a little bit, you just get some gas or particle and holes, which I showed you. And then you can describe those particle and holes in some Boltzmann-like theory. Conversely, over here, you have a superfluid, and you can use the equation of superfluid hydrodynamics and vortex motion, which are all classical equations, to describe everything, including the Coskalis-Thales transition. But in the intermediate pink region, which I've called quantum critical, is where for purposes of this talk, where I'm going to focus entirely, where the exciting things happen, where, in fact, the correct way to think of the dynamics, you can't use any of these classical pictures, and you really should think of it as a region which is to leading order dominated by just taking this very complicated conformal field theory and then raising it to finite temperatures. So now if you ask even the very simplest questions of what is the long time dynamics, you know, of this region, and in particular you ask a question, well, suppose I kick the system here, how long before it relaxes back to equilibrium? Or I perturb it by a small electric field and measure the frequency dependent conductivity. What is the shape of it? What is the value of it? For all these questions, the traditional methods of condensed matter fail completely, even for this very simplest critical point. And so that's where, in a sense, holography gives reasonable answers, and we don't know yet whether they're accurate answers because we have nothing to compare them with, but perhaps that will improve in the future. Okay, so one basic property of the system is that if you perturb it away from equilibrium, it will relax back to equilibrium in this time h bar over kt with this number c we don't know how to compute. But we know it's universal because it's a property of the conformal field theory alone. And in some sense, this is why, you know, today you would call this a nearly perfect fluid, because this relaxation is the shortest possible. If you ask similar questions in the other blue regions, you get much parametrically longer times. Okay. So what in particular, so that's the relaxation back on equilibrium. If you ask similarly, what is the conductivity, say at zero frequency? Well, similar sort of general scaling arguments tells you that if the conductivity is just given by Planck's constant. That's it. Q is just the charge of the boson, which you know. And then there's a constant of order one that we cannot estimate with any reliable accuracy with all the previous methods. Although we have tried, we're not sure. I mean, as you'll see, the results don't look terribly inspiring. But anyway, so these are the strong coupling questions of these conformal critical points, like what is the value of this number, and what is the frequency dependence of this, for which holography may give to new sort of interesting sorts of answers, which may be ultimately, if you're very optimistic, tested in experiments. Okay. But let me just go back here, and let's just try anyway to guess what the answer should look like for, say, the frequency dependent on the conductivity. Yes? There is no parameter in a sense. So how do we describe zero temperature properties? We use, say, the epsilon expansion. So there, your expansion is 4 minus, you know, from the upper critical dimension. It's of order 1, but you say it's small. But physically, what you're saying is you're expanding from the Gaussian theory. So somehow you're assuming your critical point is approximately Gaussian. That's the physical assumption. Now, formally, there's a mathematical justification, which is not real justification because epsilon is going to be put to 1 anyway. Well, so at zero temperature, you do have this parameter that seems to work because you assume it's small, although it isn't. You get an answer, and then you compare with numerics, and they all agree, and so you're happy. Okay. Now, so then the natural strategy will be, okay, go here and assume epsilon is small and proceed. See if you're going to get sensible answers. And you don't. Yeah. The same, exactly the same comments apply to large n, the vector large n. Yeah. So what happens here, at finite temperature, basically the point is the free particle picture is terrible because in the free particle limit, you get very singular answers. You don't get relaxation back to equilibrium. You don't get any damping. So to get the damping in, to get the dissipation in, I'll put it another way, there's some relaxation time. That relaxation time diverges as epsilon goes to zero. So like 1 over epsilon squared or something. And the answers you're interested in are times much longer than the relaxation time. So the order of limits of time goes to infinity and epsilon goes to zero don't commute. That's the basic difficulty. Yeah. No, you have sign problem because there is no effective classical equation of motion. You have to really simulate the full density matrix quantum mechanics, and that's extremely difficult at finite temperature and real time. And you cannot analytically continue from imaginary time either, but you don't have a sign problem here in imaginary time because these are times much longer than h bar over kt. So no matter how low you make the temperature, you have a problem with the analytic interpretation. For 1D, of course, this conformal invariance that helps you, but 1D, essentially all the conformal theories are integrable. So what that means is that you don't have thermalization, you don't have relaxation back to equilibrium. You have infinite conductivities. The CFTs are kind of special in 1D, and they don't have all these interesting thermodynamic and hydrodynamic phenomena at all. They're just absent, at least in the CFT limit. Once you go beyond the CFT, then there are things, but then they're not universal. But 2D and above strongly coupled CFTs are, you know, really beautiful objects in the sense because they're not integrable. They are chaotic enough to display all these non-equilibrium physics, if you wish, and they are still universal. Okay, so that's all right. That's the kind of question. Let's sit here and forge ahead anyway. Let's assume that the correct way to think about this regime is to start here and then move that way. Okay, so then here I had some particles and holes. So write down the very simplest possible Brownian motion for those holes and particles. You write down some equation like this, where this is some collision time between the particles. And F is the electric field that you're applying to get the low frequency conductivity. And you integrate this equation as you do in first year graduate stat mech, and you would get this as your sigma of omega is something like this. Okay, the Boltzmann equation, a little more complicated, but not much more. And this collision time, you'd say, is of h bar over d. So you take the real part of this, so that'll give you the low frequency dependence on the conductivity. And at high frequencies, well, then you know you have to use a little bit of conformal field theory. High frequencies are like zero temperature, so you can just do some scaling arguments, do some operator product expansions, and you conclude that it must be some constant, which is non-zero. So that's all under good control by traditional methods. And so you would then write down a shape like this for the real part of the conductivity. It's got this what we call a Drude peak of width, the collision time, and then it saturates to some high-frequency conformal result. Okay. All right, so one question is we can ask for this very basic critical point of Wilson and Fisher, is this shape correct? And the short answer is we don't know. We don't really know. So what could be another possible shape? Well, another possible shape is this whole picture relied on starting from the insulator. But why should I start from the insulator? Why don't I start from here? Well, if I start from the superfluid, then what are my excitations for which I would write down some Boltzmann theory? Well, the excitation of the vortices. Now, these vortices are also point particles in two dimensions. So I can write down a theory for the diffusion and collision of these vortices. Okay, so let me do that in exactly the same way. So there is a theory I can write down for the motion of the vortices. It has long-range gauge forces. It has an emergent gauge field. So that makes the analysis a bit more complicated. But anyway, in principle, you can do it. But one thing you have that comes out of this general analysis is that the conductivity that you're measuring is equal to the resistivity of the vortices. And this is, you know, a basic duality between the Joubert relation and Ohm's law. When you have vortices that move this way, then you develop a voltage in the other direction. So current of vortices develops a voltage, whereas a current of particles is a current of particles. So a current of vortices is not a current of particles. So the voltage and currents get interchanged, and therefore the conductivity is just resistivity. So if you just naively, although this may be a bit too naive, but if you just naively say this is true at finite frequency, then you would take the Boltzmann theory of bosons and say, well, really you should get the flip answer. Because the resistivity, if I was thinking in terms of vortices. So these are the two possible answers. Either I describe the critical point in terms of vortices or in terms of bosons, and I get very different answers, and I don't know which is the right one. Okay.
Why do you think it goes down and then goes up again?
It can't go to, well, okay. So the Drude formula goes to zero. Okay. This would just be a Lorentzian that goes to zero. We know it goes to a non-zero constant. Now, it could go to zero monotonically, it could. So this is written in the limit where the collision time, collisions are weak. So the answer could be something very boring, just go straight. Yeah. But the whole picture only makes sense when the collisions are weak, all this qualitative picture. So if you do a 1 over n expansion, say, you can compute this in the traditional 1 over n expansion. What I did a long time ago with Kedar Domley. So you get a very singular shaped curve. This is of order 1 as n goes to infinity. This is of order n, so it becomes really big and very narrow. And so it has this kind of shape, but it does this have the same shape at n equals 2? We don't really know. Okay. Probably it does. I mean, because, well, okay, I have my biases. But certainly the accuracy of these numbers that you get in the 1 over n expansion is zero, basically. I mean, they're not, yeah, they are not accurate at all. Okay, I think there will be. I mean, there could have been in some quantum Hall critical points a few years ago, but people were not interested in these questions. They were looking at other things. For the Bose gas, the Bose gas 2D critical point has only been studied last year. It's in a somewhat inhomogeneous system. But, okay, I think in the next decade, I'm hoping, stimulated by maybe the theory, there will be. There can be. There's no reason why they can't be. Yeah, just a question of work. It certainly won't cost billions of dollars. It's just $1 million. Okay. So now let me just review how this would be addressed from a gravity dual perspective. Okay, so what's the basic actor in gravity duality? It's this very simple Einstein action for gravity in this case 4 dimensions. So my here in this picture, my 2 plus 1 dimensional critical point, my bosons are living on this boundary of 2 plus 1 dimensional boundary here. Time is not shown. Everything, this is space, and this is the so-called holographic direction. And in holography, the physics of this system on the boundary is mapped onto theory of gravity in the bulk. And if you take a highly supersymmetric gauge theory in the large end limit, like the so-called ABJM model, which is a conformal field theory, more complicated than the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, but you know, in some moral sense, physically very similar. And if you take such a theory, then the dual theory is some complicated theory of supergravity. But in the large end limit, if you're just asking basic questions like charge transport and energy transport, then it's sufficient to just focus on just the metric. And so you get the Einstein action with a negative cosmological constant. N? So this is a no. It's a gauge theory, an SUN cross SUN gauge theory, and it's a large end limit of that gauge theory. It's a matrix large end limit for which you get this gravitational theory. Okay, if you really want a model for which this works. Okay, so now the one solution of this is just anti-de Sitter space, but there's also a solution with a black brain here. And what is that doing? Well, that black brain has a temperature, and turning on the black brain is the same as turning on a temperature going upwards in my phase diagram on this conformal field theory. So you just pick a temperature for this. And now, by the rules of the ADS-CFT correspondence, which there are many nice review articles, I'm not going to explain them here. If you want to compute the conductivity, the way you do it is you perturb the system. You put in a source term for the current, so you're going to measure the current-current correlation function. Now, you could do that by just computing things on the boundary, but another way to do it is to think of that external perturbation as perturbing the theory in the bulk, and that launches waves that fall through the black hole. And because they fall through the black hole in some self-consistent way, you end up getting dissipative transport coefficients on the boundary. Okay, it's a lightning summary of many years of work in the quark gluon plasma also of these kind of phenomena. All right, so now we're not interested really just in pure gravity, we're interested in the current, electrical current. And again, by the rules of gauge gravity duality, that current is associated. So, you know, there's a charge density whose time component of the charge, and there's it flows, so that's the spatial current. That's dual to a gauge field. So this is an emergent gauge field in the bulk with it's a U1 gauge field with flux FAV. Now, A and B go over four, have four components. So you put in the simplest Maxwell action, and if you're only perturbing, you're only looking for linear response in the current, that should be sufficient. So at this point, now you have a parameter, this charge E, which you don't know. Okay. Well, you can fix it for the ABJM theory, but if I'm going to view this as an effective field theory for a more general conformal field theory, then I don't know the value of E. Okay. But, you know, okay, so this is what we tried a long time ago, but with Rob and Ajay, we looked at a more general theory. We said, let's go a little bit beyond the very simplest theory. And one another here, the philosophy is you can think of this action as some gradient, some first term in some very complicated infinite series of terms, of which are giving you some effective low energy holographic theory for your conformal fixed point. And so you put in terms with higher gradients. So you go to up to four gradients, and you only want to keep terms which are of order f squared. And it turns out to be just one other term, and there's a new coupling gamma. Okay, so this gamma is bounded below by 1/2. So now you have two. So now what's the in principle strategy? You have two coupling constants, this coupling E and this coupling gamma, and they have some very specific numerical values for your favorite conformal field theory. And of course, for the Bose-Hubbard model, there's two questions we'd like to ask. One is, what are the values of E and gamma? But more importantly, is this a good expansion? You know, does it make any sense to stop at second order? Now, you could have asked the same question for the epsilon expansion. Epsilon is 1. Why are you stopping at epsilon first, second order? Well, you don't know. You use it, you work with it, see if you get sensible answers, compare to other methods, and that, and then your confidence starts to rise. So I would say we are in that stage. We don't know whether this is a good expansion, but let's see. Yeah. I don't want to break time reversal right now. So you could add it. There's various terms you can add. If we want to look at quantum Hall critical points, there are all kinds of other terms you can add. We're looking at the simplest case with time reversal symmetry and parity. Yeah. Okay, so then you have two parameters. So one way to fix them is to say, well, why don't you fix these parameters by comparing to results that you know how to compute? And the results we know how to compute are the zero temperature results, or the high frequency result, because everything is a function of the ratio of frequency to temperature. So that's something we're working on right now. I mean, we already know we can relate to the high frequency conductivity, and gamma is a more complicated correlation function. So eventually we will have estimates of the values of these E and gamma in your favorite conformal field theory. But having fixed these parameters now you can do something you couldn't do from any of the other approaches. You can now take this theory and go to very low frequencies. And in the go to low frequencies, much smaller than temperature, in some sensible way. And it's really this black brain that allows that whole expansion to be very well behaved. So you go ahead and do this, and Ajay did all of this. So this is the kind of results you get for sigma of omega. So it depends on the value of gamma, which is between 1/12 and minus 1/12. And when gamma is positive, then you know you get a result very similar to the kind of results I was plotting. Those plots were made in my papers many years ago, so I wasn't cheating. At least the particle plots were made. For the vortex plot, I cheated a little bit. So this looks sort of like the Boltzmann result, but not quite. I mean, it's not a very big peak. This is only 30% change. But anyway, so it's sort of like Boltzmann-like particle-like transport. And for gamma is negative, you get a result that looks sort of like my, with the benefit of hindsight, guess for what vortex transport would give you. So that's really encouraging. So it's encouraging you get physical answers that make sense. it's encouraging that this is really a relatively small correction. Gamma can't run off to anything. It's bounded. So like the epsilon expansion, it seems like this may actually converge somewhere. Well, we don't really know. But that's the hope. Yeah. Okay, yes, it is. So gamma equals zero is the ABJM theory. So if you take the supersymmetric gauge theory, you get, which is the answer we had a long time ago, you get a frequency-independent answer. And when we first got that, I was very confused by it. But now we eventually understood it. We can explicitly show that the ABJM theory is self-dual under particles and vortices. There's a self-dual transformation, and it's completely self-dual, and that's why it is frequency-independent. Yes. Yeah.
Both compartments.
Right.
So in the SU and RGN gauge theory,
yeah,
what collective aspects correspond to vertices and selfie?
So that's not the philosophy here. So here the approach I'm advocating is, we start with this solvable SU and gauge theory. Think of that as some integrable model, like something solvable by Bailey ansatz. So you solve it by Bailey ansatz, if you're solving integrable model, out of it comes Leventer liquid theory. And then you say, forget Bailey ansatz, I'm going to work with the Leventer liquid theory. It's an effective theory for any 1D system. Okay? So here I'm doing the same thing. I solve the supersymmetric gauge theory, I got this effective holographic theory. Now I forget that theory, and I'm going to work in the holographic theory, and just try to write on the most general phenomenological expansion for that theory, and then look at the predictions. But now, when I make the second step, I have to pay a price. I have a number of parameters. I don't know their values, like E and gamma and so on.
But can't you identify some master field or something of this large gauge theory?
Well, you're going to know, for example, if I give you your favorite 1D electron system, how do you fix the Leventer parameter? You say, the Leventer parameter is related to the compressibility. So then you go and you work very hard, you ask your friends in numerics to figure the compressibility, and you get the Leventer parameter.
But I'll be able to identify the fields at least.
The fields?
Yeah, not the parameters. And I'm worried about the vertices of the Bose-Hubbard model.
Well,
and the condensate.
But the fields, the whole point is the fields are referring to your bias for thinking in terms of the particles or the vortices. We should just think in terms of the current and the CFT. It's a more neutral language, which is also, I think, quite important.
So you get liberated.
Yes. Right. Yeah.
But okay. If I think of gamma as the thing that's controlling the derivative expansion, what you're showing us is that in the low frequency regime, the gamma corrections are very important to this particular quantum.
Yes, absolutely. Everything can be controlled by the gamma.
We might worry that the next order in the derivative expansion.
Yeah, okay, well, we could worry, that's right. We don't know. We don't know. But, all right, so it's taken a while to get this far, so let's see. Yeah, but it's not as singular as the what happened in the vector large n expansion. You went from infinity to finite. You had n equals infinity, you have a delta function. And then it goes from infinity to some finite value. It's very singular. Here it's okay, 30% change. It's much nicer. I guess ask this question all the time. Where's your 1 over n expansion? Well, my answer is, you could have said the same thing to Wilson and Fisher. Where's your small epsilon? Well, you don't really have it. Ultimately, in physics, when you have an expansion, it's really, you're expanding about some physical picture. And the question is that correct? And if it is correct, all the factors of 1 over 4 pi will come in a way to make things work. Okay, I'm glad Rob and Ajay are here. They should have. Okay, Rob.
No, I know in the bulk what would happen. I'm talking about in the answer for the transport.
Oh, for that graph?
Yeah.
That graph?
It just moves.
It keeps moving, but it does go crazy at some point, doesn't it?
Not for a while, not immediately, I think, right?
Yeah. I forgot.
Right, so, you know, so this calculation.
It's first order correction, we are already using the currency.
No, but he's saying.
In some sense, you know, what this calculation is doing, which maybe it has information on conformal invariance at every step. Whereas in the one over n expansion, you didn't even know it was conformal, you're just completely ignoring those constraints. You know, so if you do it, so you're arbitrarily resumming the one over n expansion in the Boltzmann equation. That arbitrary resummation has no information on conformal invariance. This one is keeping track of it at every step. That's why it's better than the Boltzmann, I think.
But if gamma's 1/6, nothing obviously goes wrong with that graph. That's the question.
We're all
yes.
Okay.
It's fine.
So you can make sense of the duality even if the bulk is crazy.
No, but what I'm saying that implies is that the correct language for this physics is the holographic language, the bulk language, because that's the language that keeps track of the conformal invariance. If you just look at this Boltzmann-like result, you can't tell, really. You're not sensitive to whether you've kept track of conformal invariance or not.
But is there something else in the dual theory that goes wrong?
There could be other things.
Just to correct that statement, when I say something's propagating outside of the light cone, I mean in the boundary theory.
Oh,
you mean in the boundary?
Yeah.
Not just the bulk.
I didn't make a statement about the bulk. I was saying excitations propagating in the 2+1 theory.
And they're
superluminal.
Yeah.
So you would have, but it won't show up in this current control.
In that particular graph.
But it'll show up in others.
I seem to remember something goes crazy if you go too far. It wasn't at this point, but
okay. All right. Well, that. So I've said that, and I've said that, and you know, I already said that too. This is in fact. Omega independent result is actually a version of S duality. It's S self duality, not just S duality. Goes back to the same theory. I mean, you can certainly apply S duality to any theory, but to get back the same theory is a special feature of the ABGM model at n equal infinity. Yeah. Okay. all right. So I have only about 10 minutes left or so, so that's fine. I wanted to explain something clearly. Start late. Okay, well, you can tell me to shut up whenever you want. But let me at least introduce the second class of problems, which is the focus of a huge amount of work over the last 2 or 3 years and continuing. There's something on the archive every day and interesting. So it's really fun to be involved in this. So what is compressible quantum matter? So let me define it. So here's a kind of very general and almost innocuous definition. Take any quantum system you want, with fermions, bosons, gauge fields, any Hamiltonian you want, but define it on the continuum in a way that's translationally invariant. And take a system which has one conserved quantity, Q. So there's some Q which commutes with the Hamiltonian. That's it. Okay. So, let me fix this. That's what I forgot. And I'm going to restrict myself to dimensions, spatial dimension greater than one. In 1D, in fact, compressible and conformal matter are the same thing. They're both Luttinger liquids. And again, it's all very special. Okay. So take a system with some conserved charge, really, and translate the invariant system with a conserved charge. That's all, the only restriction. And then I ask one more thing, that you change your Hamiltonian by this chemical potential mu, h goes to h minus mu q. And so that you change your Hamiltonian, you find a new ground state, and you look at the expectation value of q in the ground state. And the only thing I require is that q change smoothly as a function of mu. So that's my definition of a compressible system. Okay. Now you can immediately see from the definition that the compressible system has to be gapless, because if H had a gap, then changing mu a little bit doesn't change, it changes, since Q commutes with H, all the eigenstates remain exactly the same. All the energies will move a little bit. But if there's a gap, the ground state remains invariant. The ground state doesn't change at all. It's exactly the same state, when you change mu, because there's a gap, and so q will be constant, it will be a plateau. So to not have a plateau and have changes in q, it has to be a gapless system, and that's a compressible system. Okay, this is all I'm asking. You know, somewhat surprisingly, even if, at least from a condensed matter perspective, there's actually very few examples of compressible systems. This, yes. No. I mean, the conformal states I talked about before are gapless, but they're not compressible, at least in greater than two dimensions, in two and greater dimensions. Because the compressibility, you know, it comes from, when you're conformal, you have like a Dirac cone of excitations when you're gapless, and the density of states vanishes at the bottom of the cone, and so there's not enough states to give you any compressed, any charge density. It vanishes. So speaking of direct cones, so here is a very simple example of a compressible system. This is a conformal system, it's not compressible. But once I turn on a non-zero mu, then I have, now as I vary mu or about this state, the density will change smoothly. It's just free electrons here, as in graphene. And so one characteristic of this compressible state is that it has a Fermi surface, which is the boundary between occupied and empty states, at least for free electrons. And it's also what we call a Fermi liquid or a Landau Fermi liquid, because the only low energy excitations in this state are basically particles and holes near the Fermi surface. So they interact in some way, and that near the Fermi surface, that interaction is basically zero because of phase space considerations. So more formally, if I include interactions and everything, this is the more rigorous definition of a Fermi surface. It's the momentum k equals kf, that's the Fermi wave vector, at zero frequency at which the inverse of the Green's function is zero. And you can easily see that's true in the free Fermi case, but it's also true in interacting. In fact, essentially all the compressible systems we know, as you've seen in there. So this kf then is the Fermi surface, so that's the kf here, and it encloses some area. And there's a relation saying that the area enclosed by this Fermi surface should equal the total charge density Q, and that's obviously also true in the free electron, but it's true to all orders in any interaction in the Fermi liquid state. All right, so that's one compressible state, and there's, you know, whole books in solid state physics that deal with this compressible state. What are some of the other compressible states that you may have heard of? Well, there's the solid. It could happen that this system just crystallizes. And now these, you can just think of these as classical particles. So helium, you know, forms a helium solid. And now this is compressible because you can always change the lattice spacing. You just change this, you push on it, it will compress, and you add more particles. Okay. So that's another compressible state. And finally, the third type is a superfluid. A superfluid is also gapless. It's a Bose condensate. If you have fermions, you can get pairs of fermions. But one feature of this state is that you've broken the global U1 symmetry. Oh. All right, and that pretty much exhausts the list of compressible systems, yes.
Can you update any,
broadly speaking, yes.
Can you update any U1 to a gauge symmetry, like a superconductor?
So I'm thinking of a superconductor as, yes, you can in some case. I mean, if you're talking about abelian, yes, you can. There are.
Then you would call that.
Well, yeah, right now, I chose the definition to only talk about global symmetries. Okay, it becomes a little more complicated. I will introduce gauge tools shortly, but this is my definition. Okay, I want a global symmetry. It could be part of a non-abelian symmetry, but you can just pick one direction and pick one you want. Once you add the chemical potential, you've broken the other symmetries anyway. Okay. So the normal question is, are there any other compressible states? Well, in the last 10, 15 years, in work partly on spin liquids and various other systems, we do have another example of a compressible state, and I'll give you one realization of that. And that state also turns out to be have a Fermi surface, but of a rather different kind. So that leads to a conjecture. So I define compressible states rather carefully. And now I say that you take a compressible state and don't break any symmetry. So your original system had translational and U1 global symmetries, assume neither of them are broken. They were broken either the solid or the superfluid. Then what is the resulting state? Well, I claim that the resulting state must have a Fermi surface. That's a conjecture that we can operate under. And there's a huge amount of evidence. Maybe because of lack of imagination, but we don't, let me say, I think it's fair to say, we don't know of any example in condensed matter physics which violates this statement.
Yeah. So when you say preserve, you mean not spontaneously break.
Correct.
Because the superconductor doesn't.
Well, a superconductor doesn't even have a global symmetry then. Okay.
Even without the gauge field, the fermion gets a gap. Right?
Yeah, but the superconductor is compressible. It breaks the global. Superfluid is a better word. You forget about the gauge field. It has a global human symmetry and it's broken. It's broken in a conventional way, just like in Higgs space. Not in Higgs space, just the way. It's just broken spontaneously.
That's it.
But does it have a Fermi surface?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. So, well, but it doesn't preserve the global U1 symmetry.
That's what I...
It is compressible.
I was asking about what that word
is. It's compressible. You can't add single particles, but you can add pairs of particles at zero energy, and then it's compressible. Okay. So, this is the claim, and we don't know of any counterexample. That's the honest answer. As far as I know, in condensed matter, where you have something compressible which preserves both of these symmetries and which doesn't have a Fermi surface. There is no known, there are various claims by various in various papers, but I don't trust them. Okay, anything that I believe obeys this. Okay. And I can show where they're going wrong. All right. And also, you have Fermi surfaces which obey this relation that the sum of all the Fermi surfaces area must equal the total charge Q. But one important twist, which is what makes the problem non-trivial and interesting, is that these systems with Fermi surfaces, which are not Fermi liquids, they can have some emergent or gauge fields around, and that makes the excitation near the Fermi surface much not as well defined. But still, the Fermi surface exists as a sharp object. Okay. Just to be concrete, here is one model that we looked at recently. And this model is kind of inspired by, those of you know what this is the workhorse of gauge gravity duality. You put it in a chemical potential, and you simplify without throwing out the baby with the bathwater, and then in the end, you end up with this kind of simple model. You have a theory with a global U1 charge and a gauge U1 invariance, both global and gauge, but separate gauges. The fermions, the two species of fermions, F plus and F minus, that carries global charge 1 and opposite gauge charges. And similarly for bosons, this is the basic theory. And so you could, let me just skip that, and you can write down this Lagrangian. Of fermions now interacting with the U1 gauge field with sigma equals plus or minus 1, bosons interacting with the gauge field with sigma equals plus or minus 1, and various contact interactions. So that's your theory, okay? So you could play with this theory now using traditional condensed matter methods and ask what are the possible compressible ground states of this theory at some generic chemical potential mu.
Okay. So
this
ABJM model, too difficult to explain it.
In the 5 minutes, yes. it's basically a double Schön sinus theory with an SUN cross SUN and then huge amounts of the maximal amount of supersymmetry in three dimensions. And it is in the larger limit dual to super n equals 8 supergravity and ADS4 and things like that. Amazing that words I can now give you. I didn't know what they meant 3 years ago. All right, so what are some of the states? So keep think in mind, I have a bunch of fermions and bosons which have opposite gauge charges. Okay. So now you want to make some compressible state. So one way to make a compressible state and make it kind of Fermi liquid like is, okay, I didn't define this because I skipped some, but let me explain now. So you have bosons and fermions, with opposite gate charges. So you could imagine one boson will find another fermion in the form of bound state. That will have charge, Q charge 2. That's gauge neutral. Now it's a fermion, so the molecule of fermions. So everything becomes molecule of fermions, and then those fermions form a Fermi surface. So that's a Fermi liquid state. The gauge field is confining. All the gate charge particles are confined. And this type of 2 comes here because it's a molecule carrying 2 particles. Okay, so that's one possible phase that you can expect, and it has a Fermi surface. Now there's another possible phase where the bosons, in a sense, disappear. Somehow they renormalize the energy, so they are gapped. But the fermions F form a Fermi surface. And now I've drawn this very shady, this is to remind me this is not a Fermi liquid. Now these fermions are coupled to this gauge field. They're also low energy gauge bosons, but there's still a very sharp Fermi surface. So it's a non-Fermi liquid, and it also obeys a Lehmann thing. Okay, so that's the basic new type of compressible state that we know of in condensed matter, which, you know, we don't fully understand it. You know, here's a quick summary of some work in the last couple of years, where we found that even this very simple problem of a Fermi surface coupled to an abelian or a non-abelian gauge field gives you a strong coupling problem. But in the end, ends up defining a compressible state with respect to this global charge, not the gate charge. And here, so in a sense, we have a compressible state where we are in much worse shape than we were in the Wilson-Fischer fixed point. In the Wilson-Fischer fixed point, at least at zero temperature, we knew how to compute things. Or we could put it on a computer and get anything you wanted at zero temperature. Here, we can't do that. We can't put it on a computer. The ordinary one over n expansion seems to be not well behaved. We think we understand qualitatively what's going on, but we'd love to have a different way of thinking about such states and its various cousins, which I won't go into. Yeah.
Do you have microscopic models for non-Fermi liquids?
Yes. Yeah. So Baskar proposed the very first one. Yes. So you take an Heisenberg antiferromagnet on a frustrated lattice, and then these Fs become spin-ons, and you can write various gauge theories for the spin liquid states, for example. Those are more insulators. They're not compressible with respect to charge, but they're compressible with respect to spin. If you apply a magnetic field, you can smoothly vary the magnetization. But they're compressible with respect to spin, not charge. So, but in my broad classification, they classify as compressible states. Okay. So I'm going to skip this. Well, I'm out of time, but let me just 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So let me now try to apply gauge. So this is the problem now. So my challenge to gauge gravity duality would be classify a compressible state. I don't care what theory you have. All you want to do is satisfy those very simple conditions: a global charge, but very smooth. Tell me all the different types of states you get. That's all. And do they correspond to this classification? And what are their low energy properties? If you can answer those questions, it'd be wonderful. Okay. So you're not trying at all to fit any experiment. You're asking some very simple basic questions on compressible states of strongly interacting particles. Okay. So how do we do this here? Well, so this was the basic actor for the conformal theory. And now we want to add a chemical potential. And the rules of the correspondence is the way you add a chemical potential is you put in you put in the gauge field, and the associated with the bulk gauge field, there should be an electric flux coming into the boundary equal to this charge density. So if you take this very simple action, just which we worked on with before, without the gamma term, and now solve it with this new boundary condition that the electric field equals the charge density at the boundary. Previously that was zero. Now all you do is the only thing you change is change that boundary condition and go ahead and solve Einstein's and the Maxwell's equations. So when you do that, even at zero temperature, you find you get a very different geometry. You get this Reisner-Nordstrom geometry. And if you look near the horizon, you get this ADS2 metric, ADS2 plus R2 metric. And roughly speaking, let me explain what this is. So dx squared plus y squared, those are the two directions, x and y. So that just factorizes. There's no x or y dependence anywhere else. So it basically means that every point in space is independent of other points. You have the same theory at every point, and every point doesn't care about any other point. They're all, well, roughly speaking, they're essentially decoupled. So that should start reminding you of mean field theory or dynamic mean field theory, because it's like a single site attractive theory. And then this T is time, and R is this radial direction, and this is a, called anti-de-Sitter space 2. It also has a, I guess, conformal invariance. It's half the conformal invariance of ordinary 1 plus 1 dimensional theories. It's sort of like the boundary. It's like a Kondo problem, if I had more time, I would explain. It's like some sort of quantum problem sitting at one point, which has power law correlations, sort of like the fixed point of a multi-channel Kondo fixed point. So what this has done is basically taken your interacting quantum system, and at low energies, rewritten it as a bunch of quantum impurity problems of these Kondo spins fluctuating independently of each other, and collectively describing the whole lattice. So it's very much in the spirit of dynamical mean field theory, where you just take a lattice problem and reduce it to quantum mechanics of one spin interacting with some bath. And it's a different way of realizing. It's quite amazing. That's what comes out, but that's what comes out. In fact, it's a lot of evidence that's correct. Okay. And so we know, so one thing you can do is now you can start with this metric, since I'm out of time, and compute various correlation functions of various fields, and you'll find that they correspond precisely to the kind of things you get from the appropriate dynamical mean field theory. And that was known a long time ago. And I have lots of artifacts. I've got too much entropy at zero temperature. There are momentum-independent singularities on the Fermi surface, and so on and so forth. And you can, in fact, trace the current thinking is that all of that, my thinking anyway, I don't know if everybody agrees with this, that those artifacts are related to the fact that this electric flux that you put into the boundary is, in fact, going right through the horizon. It doesn't change. The total Gauss's law is the total flux going into the horizon is the same as the flux coming out. And in a sense, that seems like too drastic an approximation. So what various people are, so I'm going to skip all this. Put it on this. Let's see. Right, so what people are now trying to do is improve this geometry. I got this right. So one way to improve the geometry is actually put in the matter field explicitly in the box, some fermions and bosons, and now solve this whole thing self-consistently. That's okay. In fact, I'm right now doing some of those solutions right now, but they've been done only in some approximate method. But generically, what you get is that you get matter in the bulk, which then screens the electric flux, so that there's no flux going past the horizon, or only partial amount of flux. And it turns out that states like this eventually look very much like Fermi liquids. So that's what's emerging in the last month, and that we're finally getting the conditions under which this kind of dual theory can give you the most familiar compressible state, which is a Fermi liquid. Okay, so I think I'll just stop there. Let me just put up my conclusions. So that's all topic of much research. So here are the conclusions. So I talked about first, conformal quantum matter, where I think I said everything reasonably clearly. There was a lot of interesting discussion, and basically the point here is that for some low-frequency properties, and perhaps in the future for nonlinear, non-equilibrium transport, the holographic method may become the method of choice. I'm quite optimistic that will be the case. And then I address this more complicated problem of compressible quantum matter, in which the current solutions based on the Reisner-Nordstrom black holes have a physical picture rather similar to dynamical mean field theory. And in the future, of course, what we need is a more complete theory, which goes beyond this very simple Einstein-Maxwell way of getting the geometry. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Subsequent fields.
Yeah.
Now, there is this current algebra approach, Poissonization approach, where you
sure.
define commutative. Is there any, can you elaborate on this approach in terms of that language? Or?
It's, well, so that's ultimately related to some order of the product expansion of the zero temperature theory, right? I think.
Mm.
So, but the point is that in 1 plus 1D, where that's been most successful, this in the end, temperature is not that interesting. You can conformally map the zero temperature system to a finite temperature system because you conformally map plane to a cylinder. But you cannot do that in 2 plus 1. Well, that's really the biggest obstacle. So that kind of OPE or those current algebras, in the end, would be the analog of computing the high-frequency correlation functions or the short-time expansion. And those, in our proposal, will be what you should use to compute these parameters, E squared and gamma, in your holographic theory. And you really need the holographic theory and all of its interesting properties to really go to the finite temperature or perhaps the non-Fermi liquid states where you know, moving. But you're losing, in a complete way, the particles you started your field theory with. So a finite temperature for conformal matter is this black hole horizon that does that for you, which is quite remarkable. we'll see. We don't know for the compressible states what's going to do that and how that's going to work. We don't know yet.
If I understood correctly, so this classification now in the ABS picture translates into a choice of couplings in the Lagrangian or matter that you choose.
You know, we don't know yet, right? I thought, yeah, I mean, so if you take the very simplest theory here, I think we'll have an answer to that fairly soon. If you just take this theory, where you just take some free matter here, well, matter will be coupled to the metric and to the gauge field appropriately, and then just solve some semi-classical equation of motion. And then we are going to get some phases, and that's not fully been done yet. And it's not as simple, it's quite complicated even to do that much. Is that going to be sufficient, or are you going to need some other, these dilaton fields and other things to get full phase diagram and all possible phases? What kind of geometry? The question is really what kind of geometries you get in the IR. If you don't take just some boson matter and you condense it like Kupfer did, and you form the holographic superfluid, you get a Lipschitz metric in the IR. And from many ways, that Lipschitz matrix, from my perspective, makes no sense. To describe an ordinary superfluid, it may be describing some more complicated state, which we don't understand yet. So I think things are still open, even very basic questions are open here. Yeah.
So what, all this duality discussion is really basically being for a black hole dual to something on the boundary.
Well, for the first part of my talk, yes.
Pretty yeah. Cool. And what if it's not a black hole? And what if I just have some matter distribution, a shell of matter that,
right.
You know, is Schwarzschild ADS at large distance, but I go through the shell and I match it to...
Yeah, no, with the jump, I think to describe confining states or Fermi liquid states, we will need things like that, at least at zero temperature.
So
I think in all cases at finite temperature, you will get a black hole because then you need the entropy of the horizon. But at zero temperature, so in the first part of my talk, it was all very sensible. At zero temperature, there's no black hole. At finite temperature, there is a black hole. If you do that in the very simplest theory here, not this one, in fact, there is no black hole here. I should change
Looks
that
like
picture.
Black hole,
I should change that. In the simplest theory, this one, but it's uniform. There is a black frame even at zero temperature.
Sure, but I could imagine taking that solution and cutting it off with some shell and putting something else inside.
Yeah, well,
so that presumably has to.
You're summarizing what I'm exactly doing right now. Okay, so yes, so we're going to have to do things like that to get out of the states. Yes. Right. So it's. I think these things will be understood. In the next year or two, there will be some progress along these directions. I better go and write my paper.